Telling one's own story takes personal reflection, generosity to yourself and others, and courage. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Marine biologist Beth Ann Matthews has led an adventurous life with her husband and son in Alaska and beyond. When her husband has a rare sort of a stroke, it upends their lives until they literally navigate through the Alaskan waters and find their way back to each other. This is a story of adventure on the water, of facing challenges, and emerging as stronger people. Her book is Deep Waters, a memoir of loss, Alaska adventure, and love rekindled. And we'll talk with Beth in just a minute. Later, we'll visit with Skye Blaine, who is not only an author of fiction, memoir, and poetry. She is a coach and mentor to other writers, including our guest, Beth Ann Matthews. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. Beth Ann Matthews is a respected marine biologist and taught for many years at the University of Alaska in Juneau. There she lived with her husband, Jim, and young son, Glenn. When her robust and headstrong husband has a near-fatal stroke, his response to his own recovery challenges Beth's desire to keep him safe. Let's listen to our conversation. Beth Ann Matthews, Deep Waters, a memoir of loss, Alaska adventure, and love rekindled. I am so happy to talk to you today about this book.
Well, hello, Suzanne. I'm thrilled to be here.
Something you say in your book, images of seals on the rocky beach still vivid, Jim at the helm, our son down below, I felt whole in a way I could not remember. And that was a place you got to, but it wasn't the place you started at during this whole episode in your life that you're talking about. And we will get there in a minute. It might seem overly simplistic to call this a story about maintaining and surviving a long-term relationship, a partnership, your marriage, because there's so much more to this story. But at its essence, that is what it is. So before we get into the real guts of the story, I wonder if you could tell us about how you met your husband, Jim, and those early years in your relationship before having your son, Glenn.
Oh, sure. We actually met teaching together on a schooner off the East Coast. It was a course, a field course for college students in humpback whale ecology. And we were co-instructors and we got to know each other. We had 14 college students that we were responsible for. And I remember thinking later, after we fell in love, that in a way we started off being responsible like parents for these students and all the It was a wonderful course, and we were out. We camped with them a week, 2 weeks on a schooner, and then another week back at the island. But a lot of things happened that were really stressful and wonderful, and we grew very close then. And eventually, we had both gone to graduate school at the University of California in Santa Cruz. And after that summer, we returned to the California area. And it wasn't right away, but eventually Jim got offered a job to be the research director of Glacier Bay National Park. And when that happened, he invited me to move to Alaska, which I've said before was really like a marriage proposal relative to where we were in our lives. And I said yes. And we moved to Alaska and eventually had our son there. So that's how we got started.
And you lived for many years on your boat. I mean, it's still your boat, I believe.
Yes.
You lived on the water for a long time. And how did that materialize? And I'm just curious about what that was like, because you were both maintaining careers. You're a marine biologist also. And were you teaching at that time at the University of Alaska, or did you get that job?
Yes. Well, when we first moved up there, we lived in a cabin in Gustavus, Alaska, which is the small town associated with Glacier Bay National Park. And this is another story, but we actually, while renting a home in Gustavus, we experienced there was a fire, and we lost that home, which was a very traumatic experience. But it did, what it resulted in is us debating whether to buy 5 acres of land in Gustavus, which I wanted to do. And my husband, Jim, he wasn't my husband yet then, but he was very interested in us buying a sailboat to live on. And I balked at that because I'm from the Midwest. I had spent time on sailboats. I didn't grow up in a sailing family. And then, however, he said something that really shifted my thinking. And he said, well, okay, would you rather have 5 acres of land in Gustavus or a 2-million-acre backyard that is Glacier Bay National Park and Icy Strait? And I suddenly realized, you know what? I could do that for 2 years, is what I told myself mentally. And then 7 years passed, and we had been living on the boat, spending some time on shore. I spent time on shore in Juneau when I was teaching, but that was our only home, our primary home, for 7 years. And we did explore Glacier Bay in winter, and we went, Jim's a hunter, so we went out in the fall and anchored up at remote islands, and he would go hunting, and we went fishing. And for me, growing up in the Midwest, it was just a magical, being in southeastern Alaska, living that way was beyond imagination for me, and I still miss Alaska.
That is amazing. He made a compelling argument there, didn't he?
He did. And, you know, and really, as you mentioned, we still own the same sailboat. And I, you know, we call her she, and she feels like part of the family. It's now been 33 years, and we've had many, many adventures. Certainly our most connected time as a family has been out on the boat. We did actually even take her to Mexico, and bring her back up to California. So,
and your boat plays one of the central roles in your story as well.
Yes.
You have your son, Glenn, when you were, I believe, in your mid-40s, and you both have these successful careers, and then you move into what sounds like a pretty stunning place in Juneau, not on the water, but very near it, and boating is still part of your life. And then Jim has a stroke, which changes the trajectory of everything. And that's largely the story you're telling in your book, Deep Waters. So why don't you take us there?
Okay, yes, that was a great summary. I was 43 when we had our son, and he was very welcome. I had always wanted to have children, and so that was and is a joyous part of our lives. And so when we chose to have him late in life, we really did look carefully at our own histories of health, and you know, based on our family history, and we live healthy lives. So we really, like so many people, hadn't ever planned for something catastrophic to happen to one of us. And so when the morning that my husband had the stroke, he came in and he was, you know, healthy, and we were actually getting ready to sell our house, and he was going to do some work on a skylight. And then he went from bringing me coffee that morning to basically coughing and choking, and the stroke hit us. And really, like you just said, it changed everything. All our assumptions about the future were shattered, and I shifted gears. I was working at the university, and a theme in the book is that I did love my work and feel very fortunate to have had a career as a marine mammal biologist teaching at the University of Alaska in Juneau and doing work in a national park. But I did at times let work come before family, before Jim especially. And part of the story is about how almost losing him like that really pushed me to reevaluate my priorities.
Yeah, you were maybe having a bit of a bumpy time because of that before his stroke, where he made a decision to leave his job. And then you maybe even felt pressure as the main breadwinner. And it seemed like you loved your job and you loved the work you did with students. Another, what I thought was another important through line in the story you're telling us, you talk about the importance of your sexual relationship with Jim, but it comes up really the morning that he has his stroke. It's something that's on your mind, that he wanted to make love and you were maybe thinking about work. And then just even as his recovery takes place. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and how you dealt with it in the book, because it was an issue for you, and it was on your mind that morning of the stroke.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, I when I was first writing the book, I was insecure about talking about that part of our life, as I think a lot of people might be. But I decided that it really was an important part of our relationship, and to have that through line in the book would potentially be very helpful to other couples experiencing something like us. I want to be upfront. There's no explicit sex in the book, but I think I feel very comfortable with how I show our attraction, that, you know, even at in our mid-50s, we still were very attracted to each other. We were good friends. We also had our clashes and so on, but the issue of sex did come up that first morning, and then later in the hospital, my husband was concerned about his ability to make love, and that's I'm proud of that scene. I think it could be helpful to other couples navigating medical crisis or issues that interfere with their sexual lives. Ultimately, I had let my work really kind of push aside time for Jim in general, and specifically to make love. And you know, really, you know, it was almost losing him. Certainly, I want to say jerked my chain on not taking him for granted. You know, we do go through phases, I think, especially when both people are working and they have young children, where we have to put some of our relationship aside. But this was a wake-up call to me that I can't just pencil him at the very bottom of my list and then never get to that check mark next to his name.
And after his stroke, when he's still in the hospital, and we should say, and you could talk about this in a minute, that you had him transported from Juneau down to Seattle, and you were staying down there, you and Glenn were staying down there. But that this was one of the first things he kind of wanted to do. He wanted to assess, and he wanted to make love with you. And you were a little bit nervous, maybe that he was going to have another stroke or something. And so you consulted with the doctor about it. And yes, I thought the way you talked about it throughout the book was definitely not erotic, but it was warm. It was warm.
Thank you. That's the intention. Another theme that, of course, one doesn't see themes in their life when they're happening, but in writing a book, I realized that I often was operating from a fear of losing him again. And I was fearful that if we made love, it would trigger a stroke. And my husband seemed really convinced that that wasn't the case, but I didn't trust his judgment. This was while he was still in the hospital. And when he proposed that we ask his doctor, my first reaction was, whoa, no way. You know, I wasn't comfortable, you know, asking his doctor for permission for something like that. And then, as is often the case with my husband, I later realized that, well, no, you know, actually that's not a bad idea. And so but I still felt uncomfortable at first, but he had a wonderful doctor at, this was during the rehab phase of his recovery at Virginia Mason Hospital in Seattle. And indeed, when we did finally, or when Jim brought it up and I was uncomfortable, the doctor immediately put both of us at ease and said, no, this is a very normal thing. And that, you know, other patients that he'd had sometimes brought it up, but not always. And he assured us that it would be okay to try. And in fact, in Jim's case, that it would be along the lines of
therapy.
Yes. Yeah. Well, therapeutic. Yes. Because basically his nervous system had been damaged by the stroke. And that one of the exciting things coming out of the research into brain plasticity is the importance of using, whether it's your limbs or trying to learn to walk, doing that right away and re-stimulating the nervous system to regenerate. And so I did become convinced, and we were able to find a very, I thought, sweet way to sneak off and have a moment together.
Yes, yes. So the kind of stroke he had was unusual and kind of rare. And you were in Juneau. And it, you know, Beth, it seems like Juneau must be a fairly tight community. I mean, it's not a huge town. And it seemed like you had a strong support system there. And also really in Seattle, of people coming and going. And so you get him to the hospital in Juneau, but then are really encouraged to insist that he be taken to a bigger hospital where there would be more access to specialists and services. So maybe talk about that a little bit.
I will reflect first and just say, I think another reason I wanted to write this book is that in some ways it's a love letter to all the people that helped us. Mm. And in Juneau, it is a very small town. And we happened to have, I mean, the morning of Jim's stroke, I called a friend of ours who was a nurse there, a very, very close friend, and she immediately came to help. And then there was another fortuitous encounter where another person we know, his name is David Job, and he worked there as a respiratory therapist and just happened to be walking by the ER, and he saw me, and he said, oh, you know, Beth, what are you doing here? And when I told him what had happened to Jim, like everyone who knew Jim, he was quite shocked that this, you know, healthy person who rode his bike and all that had had a stroke. And then later David returned, and he was the one who basically said, you know, I love where I work. It's a great hospital. Everybody does a good job, but this situation is serious and you need to get your husband to a bigger medical center. And you need to do that by insisting that he be medevaced out of here. At that point, I had, I think like a lot of people, you know, when you're going through something like this and then you turn your spouse or loved one over to the medical community, you kind of breathe, you're like, okay, you know, I got him here, which was true. And he was in good hands, but David suddenly made me realize that no, it was not. I was his medical advocate. I couldn't just sit back and be a passenger. I had to drive, I had an opportunity to change the outcome. And so that bit of advice is, I think, why we did get Jim much more quickly to Seattle. He would probably not have been medevaced out for 24 hours. And I was able to, and there's some luck there too, because they only had the one medevac jet that was shared between Anchorage, Juneau, and Seattle. So yes, the tight community in Juneau and then friends in Seattle played a key role in supporting us to have a better overall outcome.
Another person who played a very key role is your son, Glenn. He was just, I think, 9 years old when the stroke happens. And you were pretty straight with him throughout. and he was an important person for you during the acute phases of this, and also in Jim's recovery. And the two of you get on the jet too, and while Jim is in Seattle, you and Glenn kind of set up a little command center, home for yourself in Seattle. So talk about Glenn and the role he played during this time.
Oh, thank you, Suzanne. Yeah, no, he was really so important to me and to Jim. And as I mentioned, or we mentioned, we had our son late in life. So we were really close-knit family. And Glenn did get special, he had to get special permission to get on the Learjet, the medevac jet with me. And we rode in those jump seats, and Jim was on the stretcher to Seattle. And then after we got there, I did start to wonder if maybe we had a good friend suggested that Glenn could come home with him, that he could fly home to Juneau. And I debated that, but I really felt that our family was a triad, a three-legged stool, if you will, and that I needed to be Jim's medical advocate. I needed to be on top of my game to do that. And Glenn shored me up. So we were together, you know, almost continuously during that period of time. And then furthermore, whenever Glenn was in the room or with his dad, he really helped Jim, cheered him up. And you know, there were a couple times where naturally we and Jim especially, you know, went through fluctuations of being optimistic and then very pessimistic about his outlook. And Glenn could walk in the room and, you know, toss a ball with his dad and just change the whole mood. So we did decide to have Glenn stayed with us there for the whole 5 weeks, although there were two situations where he went away and stayed with friends and had a break from some of both the monotony, but also the stress and strain of our situation. But I am still just so grateful to our son, and certainly that brought us all closer together. But I did wrestle with that decision, whether it was the right one or not. And because my husband did pull through, I guess I think it was.
As you portray Glenn in the book, he could be a strong emotional support for you. Sometimes he was afraid during this, but he also enjoyed the lightness of childhood as well. He does sound like just a wonderful little man who you maybe couldn't have done all this without him.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, as you say that, I can still picture it. We would be in the hospital all day, and he had homework to do, and he was an avid reader, which helped. But I remember just going back to the hotel room, you know, I'd be kind of worn out and edgy, and he would just start jumping on the beds, you know, jump back and forth on the two twin beds, and and then I forgot it was Mother's Day, and he made me this little handmade card that totally touched me. And he made me laugh. I mean, also just, he just has a great sense of humor. Yeah. And of course he understood the seriousness of his father's situation, but he absolutely was still a kid. And that was like recharging my battery when he did that, sort of when those kinds of situations would happen.
In that acute phase when you were in Seattle, there were some touch and go times with Jim, mm-hmm. and you yourself got a case of pneumonia. But despite that, as you describe it, your life there was focused. It had a narrow focus. But when you got home, you resumed your work and you worried a lot because Jim was just determined to reclaim himself and reclaim his abilities. And though you thought of him as being delicate and awkward, that is really something he resisted in his own self. So talk about when you got back home and his impetus to reclaim himself and your getting back into your routine and how you had to negotiate that and how it eventually led back to the boat.
Right. While he was in the hospital, he had a team of over 20 caregivers taking care of him, taking him to rehab exercises and so on. And we flew home and he had 2 appointments a week compared to 20 or so a week. And we had been told that he, not only his doctors, but his PT, wonderful PT staff at Seattle, told me to be sure to have a wheelchair and a walker for him ready at the house. So I had called ahead and reserved those. And the first day after we got back, I had to go to work the next morning. And we lived in a two-story house with the main living area upstairs. And I did not want him going up and downstairs because he still could not walk normally. He had he could go a short stretch on his own with some risk of falling because he leaned to one side and he was supposed to use, like I said, a walker or something. And he absolutely did not want to use either of those tools. And so I was reminded, I think the feeling I have that I could share that some other people who haven't been through this might relate to is it sort of reminded me of, you know, the first time I dropped my son off at preschool and just mm-hmm. that you have that protective instinct that is like just so huge. And I had a hard time. We had there was tension between my husband and me where I was really pushing for his safety, but he recognized or was very driven, as you noted, to push himself hard. He really wanted to get beyond being able to walk. So we definitely had clashes over that, and it was hard for me to go to work. I would just have that heavy feeling in my heart driving away that what if he falls down the stairs? You know, I just could not help but have those worries.
In the book, you recount his movement in the way of independence while you were gone at work. And then he wants to go out on the boat, and you and Jim and Glenn go out on an outing. And I think I want to leave some of that for the readers to discover, you know, that initial episode when you went out on the boat. But you eventually agree to do a longer trip. And that was such an important family bonding and recognition for you on just how he could recover.
Yes. And I did have reservations. By then I had gone back to teaching. I taught a summer research experiences for undergraduates course. So he had come up with this plan for a 3-week circumnavigation of Admiralty Island, which is, I believe, the second or third largest island in the country. And you know, it was in waters and places that I loved, and we both, you know, had talked about doing a trip like that. But he was going to, I would go with him only for 3 days, and then he would be joined by a friend and our friend's son. And so that was a step for me to know that my husband would be out on the water with in good hands. Our friend Brendan Kelly and his son Corwin are avid boaters, and Brendan's a very competent field biologist. So, but I, again, it's sort of that letting go and trying not to be fearful about my husband doing these things that he was ready for, even though I wasn't. But then I joined them for most of the trip, and it was absolutely fabulous. We had a wonderful connected time as a family and spent time in a place called Baranof Warm Springs, which is a remote community, actually kind of a seasonal community with, I think, only about 15 houses, but it has these natural hot springs that are wonderful, and fishermen stop in there to use them. And it's just a very cool place in the summer where people come and go, but then something else bad happens on the last leg of that trip. So it was both bonding, and also I want to say mention that while we were out boating, our son also. So Jim could do almost everything out on the boat. He in some ways it was wonderful to see him on the boat. He did not seem impaired. And as he put it at one point, everybody on a boat is balance impaired, and there's handholds everywhere. So, you know, yes. It's kind of even up the playing field. But a developmental thing, you know, our son started playing more of a role in the boating, even though he'd always... we'd always encouraged him to do so. He sensed that it was good for him to be more part of the team than ever before. And so, yes, that was a really wonderful trip, but it did have a...
Harrowing
ending, yeah. Yes.
You know, Beth, your writing and storytelling in the book is so clear. And for our listeners, I want to say that if you like stories that include or are set in the natural world, this is a satisfying read in that regard. And your writing really pulls us into your emotions, and you have a candor that kind of cuts through artifice. And you also have written scientific papers. So how is it different, or has it been different for you from your professional writing of these scientific papers to write this compelling memoir?
Well, thank you first for that feedback. I had kept journals throughout my life, but not like journals with quotes around them, some, you know, sort of sporadically. And I liked writing, but when I started wanting, or really it was almost a drive to write some stories down about what was happening. Initially, I wasn't thinking of a book, but I just wanted to capture what was happening. And then when some of those stories started coming together in a way that that someone else, I think, even said, I think you could write a book. And then I started participating in memoir writing classes, which was transformative and in two key ways that I can think of, but many more than just these two. One was that the class I was in, we had the opportunity to read a chapter or a scene every week, which I did, and then get immediate feedback, which was very helpful. One of my first teachers was Steve Boga from the Santa Rosa area, and he had been teaching memoir writing through the community college for about 18 years. And the biggest shift, which at first when he pushed me, I thought, oh, I can't do that. He really encouraged in general that even though we were writing nonfiction, that we use novel writing techniques. And in particular, he wanted me to start incorporating dialogue into my writing, which of course, as a scientist, you almost never have any dialogue in there. Uh-huh. And at first it really did... I thought, oh my gosh, I don't know if I can do that or whatever. But then it didn't take too long. And I also, of course, when you're writing memoir or anything, you try to read in that genre. And I started paying more attention to the fact that, of course, I loved good dialogue, and I could see how it moved a story in a new and faster way than straight narrative. So I would say the biggest change was learning how to write dialogue and a lot less narrative, which scientific papers are more, not quite third person, but that would be my biggest change, and I'm still always learning more.
You also mentioned Skye Blaine as somebody who was important for you in writing this memoir, and I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about Skye.
Oh my gosh. Well, when I first started taking Steve Boga's class, Skye was a classmate there. And right away, I recognized that she was very good at giving helpful feedback. And she was also writing a memoir. And when she read her memoir, I just was so moved by that. She's a very good writer. And that story was very compelling. And then she kind of took me under her wing, is how I would say it, or how it felt. That class, I think there were a dozen or so of us, and the numbers every week would go up and down. But one day after, I'm not sure, maybe half a year or a year, she invited me to join a very small group of women, there were three in the group at that time that met on Monday nights. And it was different in that there were fewer of us, and we spent more time giving feedback on each person's work read aloud. And a couple things. I mean, number one, Skye definitely is someone who made me feel safe about writing some of those more personal sections and vetting them in a group of just women. My other class, which I loved, was much more varied, and I didn't feel quite as brave in front of that group, perhaps is a way to put it. Mm-hmm. But Skye, also another really important gift she gave me is early on, she asked me if I knew the software Scrivener, which is a writing program, a writing software, and I did not. I was using Word like so many people, and she invited me over, gave me a tutorial, and I could see right away that I wanted to learn that, as for me, it took a lot of the stress out of thinking exactly how I would organize things at the end, which a writer shouldn't worry about anyway. But I picked it up, and using Scrivener has absolutely improved my ability to put a story together, to put a book together. I hope other people, if they're interested, might look into that if they're interested in writing. So Skye has been a very important mentor and friend.
Well, I really appreciate talking to you today. And I wonder if you could leave us with really why it was so important to tell the story of your family during this time.
I have come to feel that our story is potentially a story that could help lots of families who either are or might in the future go through some kind of crisis, not necessarily the same one as ours, but where one family member is hurt in some way. I think it's ultimately an uplifting story of how a medical crisis inspired us to reinvent our priorities and ultimately to live more connected, fulfilling lives. And I hope readers get that. And plus, I think it's, even if you're not, I hope readers don't go through that sort of thing. And I think it's a really an adventure story and a love story as much as it is a survivor's story.
Beth Ann Matthews, thank you so much. Your book is Deep Waters, a memoir of loss, Alaska adventure, and love rekindled. So enjoyed talking with you.
And thank you, Suzanne. This has been a wonderful experience talking with you.
Beth Ann Matthews, and her memoir is Deep Waters, a memoir of loss, Alaska adventure, and love rekindled. Let's take a short break, and then we'll visit with author and mentor, Skye Blaine, who'll talk with us about her work with authors.
Deep in my heart, there's a place I can go, where I'm one with the wind, blowing down off the snow, far beyond thought, down where the mighty rivers flow, one with the earth, one with the stars. Home under these boundless skies, in the canyons and halls of eternity.
I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea, and that was Boundless Skies from Lacey J. Dalton. Skye Blaine is the award-winning author of a memoir, a series of fiction books, and poetry. And she is a writing coach and a mentor to other writers. When Beth Ann Matthews mentioned Skye as a great influence, it got my attention, as Beth is not the first author to acknowledge the importance of Skye in the evolution of their work. Skye Blaine encourages herself and others to discover the powerful awakening to the truth of who we are. Let's listen to our conversation. I love the way she talks about memoir as a series of scenes with characters. Sky Blaine, welcome. You are a writer with a memoir, Bound to Love, a memoir of grit and gratitude, your story of being the mother of a child growing up with disabilities. And you also have a series of fiction books, Unleashed, Must Like Dogs, and Passing the Torch. And you also write poetry. So you are a writer with range. But today I want to talk with you about the role you play with other writers. Other writers have talked about how important you have been to them.
I'm so touched by that.
Memoir is a form, you know, that's all about disclosure and disclosure through the lens of oneself, of the subject.
It requires a very safe space.
So talk about that, how you work with writers and how people come to decide that they are going to write one.
Well, first of all, my classes are based in deep kindness. I insist on kindness, and it's very easy to offer feedback that's valuable for the writers to improve their writing and still do it with a very deep kind of kindness. So, for example, instead of making statements, maybe I'll ask a question. In a piece, the brother might come across as very overbearing. And so instead of saying that, I'll ask, did you intend for your brother to come across this way? Or, you know, be curious rather than making assumptions about what the writer means. And I think that's been helpful. And I'm also very attentive to how the students are responding to each other. And what I learned is not only verbally, but what are their written comments like? Because the way we work, we print the work, everybody has a copy, and we're doing this on, have been doing this on Zoom for 3 years now. We write comments on the copy, but also make verbal comments during the Zoom session. And what I learned was that sometimes the comments on paper were rubbing people wrong. And what I had to train my students about is that when you write on paper, they can't see your expression or feel your heart or your warmth like they can in person or on Zoom where they can see you. So they need to take special care when writing comments. And once that got communicated, the problems have pretty much ended. I also have a wonderful group of students. They're all behave like grown-ups. It's the most wonderful group. I've discovered that not all people our age do, but this group is very mature and lovely to work with.
I imagine that the sort of exposure that a writer of memoir has to engage with can be very difficult to achieve. And I'm wondering when you talk about kindness, that in being kind or compassionate to fellow writers allows maybe a writer to look differently at their own work as well.
And at their own selves, I think. Yes, I think that's true. And one thing that I suggest if they're working on a really difficult issue or relationship and they're trying to write about it, and it's something that holds a lot of pain for them, I suggest that they touch it lightly many times rather than trying to dive in for hours at a time. In other words, spend 15 or 20 minutes, then go do something that nurtures you and makes you feel good. Then think about dipping back in again. And I think some of the students have found that helpful when they're approaching difficult material.
I wonder how one finds or creates their own storytelling voice. I mean, one is telling their own story, but they're telling it for others. How does one find that authentic voice that is uniquely theirs that communicates?
By writing and writing and writing and then editing. and editing and editing. And, you know, each of these students has a very unique voice. I can pick up their writing without their name on it and know who it is. That does develop over time. We have to work our craft. And I encourage them to write every day. I think most don't, but maybe they do write two or three times a week. For me as a writer, I have to write every day. If I don't, it's like the muse, and I don't even know what that is, but it's like she goes and wanders off to be with someone else. And then it's much harder for me to pick up the thread. So right now, I write a poem every morning at dawn after I wake up. And that opens the vein. It's a cliche, but it seems like a pertinent one to me. And then I can continue writing or editing my work throughout the day. So I think regularity is really important in finding your voice.
I wonder what the most common thing, if there is one, that you see in people's writing of memoir that needs to be modulated or changed.
Their use of lay and lie. That's not what you meant, but... You know, another thing that I have talked about with the students is you don't ever want to point fingers, that it is possible to show another person's behavior when it has been inappropriate, not tell about it, but actually lay out the scene for the reader. And in that way, no fingers are being pointed, and the reader gets to say, oh, that person was really cruel. It doesn't say cruel in the book or in the manuscript. And I think that's a safety both for retribution after you publish. You know, you don't want that. You don't want people creating lawsuits against you. But I know in my memoir, I dealt with one of my ex-husbands who was very difficult, but I never blamed or pointed fingers. I just showed the scenes. And then the reader gets to make their own decision about how they feel about that particular character in the story. So I think that's a learning area where sometimes work needs to be modulated.
And are there people who you work with who come in one way or have an idea of how they want to tell their story, but through the process of regularly meeting together and reflecting on the work, you see their work substantially change in that author and how they're expressing themselves?
Suzanne, I think it's more often that they come in and they have no idea how they want to tell their story. And I just share my own experience with them that I had rewritten my memoir maybe, I don't know, 6 times. But that means that I had touched each scene in it tens of times. It had been through 3 different critique groups, you know. And yet, it was when somebody reflected on the title that I had chosen and how they felt that it wasn't a good title for the book, and they suggested another title, and that is the current one of Bound to Love, I realized that the theme throughout the book, that theme needed to be brought forward. But that didn't come until the manuscript had been done and worked on a lot. And I had to do rewriting to build it around that most obvious theme that I had not seen.
I wonder what sort of advice or encouragement you can give to people out there listening right now who maybe aren't necessarily writers, but who have something to say about their own lives.
Every one of our stories is valuable. Each of us is a unique being, and we're planted on this planet for the time that we have. And I feel we need to share ourselves, that's how we learn from each other. And every story can be valuable to tell. And I encourage them to give that to themselves, to value themselves in that way. And in the end, if it's writing only for themselves, that's fine. They're going to learn a great deal from the process. What's interesting to me in writing memoir is, you know, there's a thread of a memory that's nagging. So the writer picks at it a little bit. And those memories will open and people are amazed at what they recall after they spend time unpacking a memory that at first might have just seemed like a snapshot. And then when they start unpacking it, it just unfolds into a very rich scene. Now, one thing I always recommend to writers, and if they're going to publish, it certainly went in the front of my book, and that is that that memory is unreliable, and that these are my memories, and that the other people in the story have different memories of the same incidents, and that would be their stories to tell, and that I have tried to be as honest and clear and forthcoming about my own faults in the story as well, because we need that in memoir. We need for the writer to be very forthcoming about their own weaknesses and the part that they played in these scenes.
And I wonder if you also give guidance, or people have called you their coaching on structure and pacing and I want to say some narrative elements that reading a good memoir often has, you know, temporal shifts and that sort of thing. So how do you approach working with writers on the actual structure of the memoir?
I have to say, Suzanne, I don't think this is my greatest strength. Mm. I can certainly help them learn about how to switch time. So we're in present story time, and maybe present story time is 1974. And then they want to reflect on a memory from, you know, 1950. I can certainly help them structure that in a way that the reader doesn't get lost when they move into the memory that is past the present story time. There are tricks about how to do that. And I can certainly make those available to them. But as to the structure of the whole manuscript, I don't think I'm as strong in that area. But people find it over time, and it often will come out of the theme that they don't see when they begin writing. And I just tell them, you just need to keep writing and writing and writing and writing. And eventually, and it may not be until you're through three drafts, a theme is going to become apparent. And then you rewrite again, structuring around that theme.
Sky, I thank you so much for sharing with us your voice and your take on memoir writing and how important it is really to externalize your work in a safe space with people who are kind, I think is how you put it, kind, deep kindness.
Yes.
That can really only serve to help us all. Because I imagine that when a book is written in that sort of space, that the way it comes out is also different, maybe less filled with bitterness. I feel that I've read a few memoirs that I thought were filled with bitterness.
Oh, I have too. And I'm always so sorry, because to me, it means that the writer didn't do the work to see their own part. It's never one-sided.
Yes.
And there's another thing I want to mention that we haven't talked about, and that is that if a writer decides to publish their memoir, there is a deep sense of vulnerability when it goes public. They are worried about how their families are going to respond. They're worried about how their friends are going to respond. And it's something I try and prepare them for beforehand. They will feel very vulnerable.
Yes, Yes, I can imagine. What is the satisfaction in telling one's story?
I think in being seen in a deep way. And I know for me, when I wrote the memoir about my son and the challenges that he had, I was really hoping that it would find a readership with other mothers who had children with unique challenges. How I addressed the medical system, for example, what I learned in that process of how to stand up and protect my son as best I could in that environment, those kinds of things. Hopefully, the writer has come out the other side and is able to share the lessons that they've learned. And if that's the case, then I think the read is much more satisfying for the reader. That's why I want people to write memoir. Share what they've learned.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you, Skye, for sharing what you've learned today with us. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Skye Blaine is the author of Bound to Love, A Memoir of Grit and Gratitude, a trilogy of novels called The Pensing Connection, which include Unleashed, Must Like Dogs, and Passing the Torch, and she is now recording these as audiobooks. Earlier, we visited with Beth Ann Matthews on her memoir, Deep Waters, a memoir of loss, Alaska adventure, and love rekindled. I am Suzanne Lang, and I thank you for listening today. We have production assistance from Will Penny and Mark Prell. We are a production of Lit Radio and KRCB Northern California Public Media. Listen to our podcasts and find past shows at krcb.org. Follow the podcast or program links. It's a novel idea.